Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Idea Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:03 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 29th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would look at a few ratios starting off in here today. The first one that we're looking at right now is the copper-oil ratio. And I think it's relevant because as we think about copper, it's often been considered Dr. Copper and reflective of infrastructure development and telecommunications infrastructure. But as we look towards the upcoming decade, then there is the potential that it will also have much more demand sources, such as in transportation and in renewable energy ventures. So it's an interesting one because renewable energy is cutting into demand for fossil fuels, but it's the evolution of the battery sector is cutting into demand for oil. Well, the ratio got up to a peak in approximately 1988, and then copper underperformed oil by a really quite substantial margin for the next decade. Then, as the commodity bull market picked up in the early 2000s, copper went into a very gradual process of appreciating versus oil, but there's no trend there. Then it massively outperformed in early 2020 because oil prices went negative. So that resulted in a massive spike higher. And since then, oil prices have in fact been rising faster than copper. So I think as we look out towards history and think about what is likely in terms of the oil market overall, well, we can look at lots of back history if we look at the historical price, but it's only updated once a month. And I think it's done so with a 1 month lag as well. But we do get to go back for more than a century. And when we do go back more than a century, well, what we're presented with are a series of ranges and a series of bull markets. And each of the ranges has lasted decades. And the bull markets tend to last about a decade. So we had a very significant bull market up to the peak in 2008. Subsequently, that peak has not been superseded. And then we had this profound decline in oil prices in 2020, and now the price continues to recover. West Texas Intermediate is now up to approximately $50, and it has been very inert for the last 2 weeks. So that's an incredible move. It's a $90 move from trough to peak, which is quite profound. But as we look at this over the very long term, then the chances are that we're not quite at the end of this bull market overall, of this ranging phase overall. The reality is that commodity bull markets are defined by the rising cost of marginal production. And as the cost of marginal production rises, it encourages investment in new sources of supply that were previously uneconomic. So people have known, for example, about shale oil and gas for over a century, but they were uneconomic to produce. And then prices went up enough that, and technology improved enough that they could be brought into production. But the reality is that they are still reasonably expensive. And you're going to just really need to see a move above $60 in order to confirm or at least to provide the incentive for producers to go out and borrow the money necessary to start drilling unconventional wells again, because horizontal drills and hydraulic fracturing are considerably more expensive than conventional wells. They won't deploy that kind of capital until they can lock in a profitable margin via the futures curve. And when we think about, well, where is the futures curve? Well, we have a short-term backwardation. So prices do continue to rise overall. Prices in the short term are higher than they are out in the curve. But the reality is that if you're going to engage in a drilling project, you're not going to be selling on the front end. You're going to be selling somewhere out on the curve at least 12 months forward. And if we look at where 12 months forward is, well, it's really more around the $50 level. So we don't have a great uptick in rig activity just yet, simply because of where the price curve is. But as we move further into a global reflation, the chances are that oil prices will recover a bit further. We will get more supply coming back into the market, and then that will confirm that we're still in a ranging environment overall. Now, if we think about where are we with the copper price? Well, copper prices have rebounded and broken out to new recovery highs. They did not pull back into negative territory, and there has been a range underway now, I think arguably since 2006. Yes, we certainly had a pop on the upside in 2010 and 11. It was not sustained. It came all the way back down to test the $2 level on the COMEX contract, and now we're coming back up towards the 350 area. Well, there's no doubt that we have a short-term overbought condition, but the reality is that the vast majority of automotive manufacturers are talking about releasing large numbers of new electric vehicle models within the next couple of years. So the demand for copper is going to multiply as each one of those new cars hits the road, and or at least goes into production. That also represents a loss of demand for oil. So we're likely to see a transition overall. Well, what if we then go back and think about, well, what does that copper oil ratio look like? Well, I think it's unlikely we're going to see the price go all the way back down to the lows, and that over time, it's logical that we should see copper start to outperform. But we don't see it yet. There's still a degree of reticence to give that conclusion a full credibility on the behalf of investors. And the good reason for that is they don't have the evidence. The number of electric vehicles on the road are still really quite small. So it's a small market, and you don't have the evidence of demand for the metals. But the one thing we know is that these plans that are underway on behalf of the automotive manufacturers have got a long tail. They can't just change their minds once they've made that decision. And it does suggest that while oil might be rallying more than copper at the present time, then that is not a sustainable trend overall. I think the other rather interesting ratio that we have right now is the platinum palladium ratio, because it's been trending downwards for more than a decade. And we've seen the first evidence now of a return to demand dominance on a relative basis for the platinum price relative to palladium. If copper is a transportation fuel and an energy production fuel, then nickel is primarily about transportation, and demand for nickel sulfide continues to trend higher. It's a purer form of nickel, it's more expensive to produce, and demand for it continues to trend higher. Palladium is a byproduct of many different types of nickel mining resources. So, as demand for batteries increases, then supply of palladium will increase, but demand for palladium could decrease. Therefore, the evolution of nickel mining is likely to be a death knell for the very impressive bull market that we've seen in palladium over the course of the last few years. It has massively outperformed platinum, going from 5 times of what platinum went from 5 times the price of palladium back in 2009 to less than half of the price of palladium. That's as much about the big decline in platinum as it is about the profound bull market that we've seen in palladium. And it's quite logical that we're going to see people play that ratio, because platinum demand declined meaningfully as a result of the diesel cheating scandal, but it is also an integral catalyst in hydrogen fuel cells. So as demand for green hydrogen, or hydrogen generally, tends to trend higher, then it represents a new demand use case for platinum. But when we look at the absolute price chart of palladium, this looks like a type 1 top with type 2 right-hand, or massive reaction against the prevailing trend and right-hand extension. And it is now pulling back and testing the region of the trend mean. Palladium is going to have to bounce and do so in a dynamic manner next week in order to offset the potential that this is a completing top formation. And it could have a really rather profound decline, considering just how low platinum is and the clear evidence that we're looking at is people are playing this pairs trade. So they are buying platinum but simultaneously shorting palladium. Now, platinum prices have finally been able to push through the 1,000 level. They tried it back in 2016. It just wasn't sustainable and it came right back down into the range. But this is a five-year base formation which has just been completed, and there is ample scope for additional upside. If we stay with the precious metals market for a moment, then silver prices rebounded yesterday, didn't quite hold the advance, popped on the upside again today, didn't quite hold the advance. The most important thing that's happening, if we just strip out any other reason, is that it is bouncing from the $25 level. That's the upper side of the underlying range that was formed between October and the middle of December. It's confirming support in the region of the trend mean. If we zoom out and look at the longer term chart, well, we're presented with a lengthy base formation all the way through from 2014 to 2020, then a very impressive breakout. And this doesn't look like much more than a first step above the base. Now, if we then think about what does the gold-silver ratio look like? Well, and I'm just going to find that. It's very hard to think and talk at the same time. When we think about the gold-silver ratio, one thing that is abundantly clear is gold tends to move first. And it does tend to have a really big move before people are convinced that it's a new bull market. So gold outperformed from about 1998 all the way through until 2003. And then silver outperformed all the way through to the peaks in 2007. It fell relative to gold during the crash in 2008 and then went on in a spectacular advance where the price of gold halved versus silver. So silver doubled relative to the gold price, and that was during a time when gold was already in a really quite profound bull market, and then all the way through until the lows this year, well, in 2020, where silver underperformed by an incredible margin. But now it has rallied impressively. It has broken the gold's uptrend versus silver, and it was at a new reaction, or gold was at a new reaction low relative to silver this week. Now, this is, I think, important because it tells us that demand for silver is outstripping demand for gold. And historically, that has only tended to happen during the big bull market phases. So we've now left behind the early stage of the gold bull market, or the bull market in precious metals overall. And we are now in the acceptance stage. I think that's important to remind ourselves of, because gold prices have been coming down for the last 5 months, and they're still pausing today in the region of the trend mean. And we've had certainly a degree of uncertainty over the course of the last 2 weeks because gold hasn't really been able to sustain upward moves, and we had another example of that in here today. Of course, gold is a much bigger market than silver, so it takes a lot more money to move gold than silver, and it's quite likely that we can, and I think this has to be the base case, that silver will both outperform gold in the rest of this cycle, but that it will also move first. So we've seen a change of leadership, and that is quite consistent with what we would anticipate from the second and third stages of a new precious metals bull market. So we've definitely seen appetite for risk starting to increase. Now, when we look at the gold miners, GDX is laden with dividend-paying gold miners, and it's also been in a corrective phase, and it was also weaker in here today. This, though, looks really quite similar to the silver chart overall, because it has first step above the base characteristics. And I think it's only a matter of time before we start to see demand starting to come back in. Then when we start to think about the junior gold miners, well, none of these companies tend to pay dividends. We had a very brief breakout in the middle of 2020. It has come right back down and testing now the upper side of the underlying base formation and the region of the trend mean. So this looks like an area where if support is going to be found, it should start to be coming back in. Well, when companies don't pay dividends, they generally tend to be more risky. The other thing about the junior gold miners is that they often tend to have higher costs of production. Well, a higher cost of production means it is more levered to the gold price because a small move in the gold price to take it from a loss maker into a profit maker, well, that's a profound change for a company and it greatly enhances their scope for outperformance. The small move for a profitable gold miner, it might pad the bottom line, but it doesn't have quite the same impact on the business model. So higher priced producers do tend to outperform as we move into a more speculative or a speculation tolerant period of the bull market. Then, of course, we have the explorers. And when we think about the gold explorers, well, they are much more risky than the junior gold miners. They're more thinking about how to bring new resources onto the production schedule. So that ETF has not broken out of its base formation. So investors are still wary of explorers. Now, that is the clearest evidence we might wish for to tell us that we're not yet in the third psychological perception stage of the gold bull market. I really rather think that we've only just begun the second stage. So gold and gold investments are still a minority way of participating in this market. There is certainly demand for a hedge against the proclivity of governments to debase currencies. At the moment, that is being focused in the cryptocurrency markets. And Bitcoin rebounded rather emphatically for a time in here this morning, and then it wasn't quite able to hold on to all of the advance. It reacted in a very profound way to statements, or I guess tweets, by Elon Musk. But it hasn't held on to the gain. The reality is that Bitcoin at $34,000 requires a lot more money to move it and to sustain strength than it did back when it was $400 or even $4,000. So that does suggest that it requires lots of additional money to support it. When we think about the rather profound moves we've had in GameStop over the course of the last few days, a number of the exchanges, a number of the brokers had to curtail trading in the share yesterday because the activity was so intense and the demand for margin from the clearinghouses was so high that they didn't have the capital to put it up to ensure safe trading. Now, there are a lot of theories circulating about the backroom deals that might have gone on. And there is a feeling among the retail investors that they are being wronged. Well, the forming of investment pools is technically illegal. There's obviously a high tolerance for it, and momentum investing isn't exactly or isn't even remotely close to being illegal. But it's also representative of the power of the internet to allow groups to coalesce around ideas. This is exactly the same kind of moves that we saw in the early days of the cryptocurrency markets. The difference, of course, is that stocks are much more regulated and much more public and much more accessible, and a lot more people are interested in what happens. There isn't any really good reason why GameStop should be trading at $300. It's a marginal business at best. I think it's quite likely that if the management of the company have any sense at all, they will go to the market and provide the short sellers with new shares. They'll get to charge them $300 for each new share. And that will ease the buying pressure. There's no question of that. It may alienate the retail investors, so they might be burning their potential customers in the future. But it would create a cash windfall for the company that could ensure its survival for years into the future. It might even provide them with the resources necessary to move online in a manner that has so far escaped them, and they totally missed out on that opportunity, and that's all on current management. But this kind of activity in stocks is not sustainable. There's the clear potential, of course, that it will migrate to less regulated markets. That, I think, is why silver popped on the upside the last 2 days. It's also why the renewed activity has come back into the cryptocurrency markets, in much the same way that silver is a high beta version of gold, Ethereum is a high beta version of Bitcoin, and it has been outperforming this month. And that's been true despite the fact that Bitcoin has been pulling back now for 3 weeks. The Ethereum price is still in the region of its new all-time peak, and this looks like just a pause in the region of the previous peaks from back in 2017. Of course, if Bitcoin were to break downwards, well, it would likely take Ethereum with it. But unless, or I guess until that happens, it's quite likely that Ethereum will continue to outperform. As we think about what the bullish arguments for Bitcoin might be, it's that it's a digital asset and it can't simply be printed into existence. And it is a useful resource for moving assets internationally because there's no penalty for moving in size. What you give up for in terms of accepting that ease of moving sizable sums is speed, and it is quite a slow process relative to how quickly electronic payments can move internationally. But then, of course, we have the point that the more successful Bitcoin becomes, the greater the threat it becomes to the established financial system. And that is obviously a factor in some of the statements we've seen from Janet Yellen over the course of this week. So I think that we can probably conclude that Bitcoin is pretty similar to Netscape. It was the original, and it might be around for the foreseeable future, but that the sector will move on. And we're moving increasingly towards digital currencies. That's probably no more, there's nowhere more developed in that drive than China. And the other important point about China right now is that they are apparently willing to allow the renminbi to continue to appreciate. The reality, perhaps, is they don't have a lot of choice. And the reason for that is they supplied the market with a great deal of additional liquidity. That stoked really impressive speculative interest in a small number of shares, but also in bank lending and particularly to the property markets. In many respects, the US is an equity market. Europe is more like a bond market. It's the primary market that people invest in. But in China, the primary market that people invest in is property. And the Communist Party cannot afford to have a property crash. So they are trying to manage the inflation of the bubble. There's no argument that Chinese property prices are extraordinarily high, that it is when you have 50 million vacant residential units, then you know that you've got lots of oversupply. But it's only oversupply when it comes onto the market. And as long as it's retained from the market, well, then prices can continue to rally. Of course, the last thing they want is for the rally to take off. So every time there is a pop on the upside in terms of prices, then they start to withdraw some of that liquidity. Now, this, I think, was a really rather interesting graphic from Alpine Research. It's China's credit impulse. And we can see here that this goes back to 2010. And it's just peaked. So the credit impulse now is likely to go negative. And that suggests that aggregate financing is also going to pull back and potentially contract by upwards of about 5 trillion renminbi. Then, if we just contrast that move higher in terms of the Chinese stock market, well, I think we can now conclude that we're going to see what it looks like for extraordinarily highly valued shares to experience a dearth of liquidity, because China looks like it is pulling back on liquidity. BYD pulled back rather sharply this week. It's not quite a downside weekly Q reversal, but it is extraordinarily overextended when we think about Great Wall Motors. It's also done spectacularly well over the last 12 months, and it is already in the process of unwinding that outperformance. So it could have, and it would still only be in the region of the trend mean. As we look at what's happening in terms of SHIBOR rates, well, that's the Shanghai Interbank Offered Rate, and if we look at that on a long-term chart, we can see that it has just cleared the 3% level. So overnight rates are now 3.25. If we then think about the 3-month rate, and we're seeing another pop, but not quite as acute. And we've seen the big jump back from the lows in the middle of or the first quarter of 2020, but the absolute rate right now is at 2.75. So there's a 50 basis point pickup between the overnight rate and the 3-month. And that's really incredibly acute. So it is very actively squeezing money out of the system. And now the big question is, how long will the government in China persist in this kind of activity? As we then think about what that means in terms of 10-year government bonds. China it was announced this week, was more successful in attracting foreign direct investment than the USA for the first time in nearly a decade in 2020. And government bonds trading at 3.18% represent attractive value from the perspective of an international investor, where there are still in excess of $16 trillion that have got a negative yield. So the ability to pick up a 3% yield in a currency that is appreciating, well, then that is the kind of investment that people will want to take. And with liquidity contracting rather than expanding, it means the bonds are worth more. So there's the potential that we're going to see China's government bonds starting to contract again, because investors will start to think about what the potential is, that with the contraction in liquidity, then economic growth might moderate, and then the loss of supply from the currency markets will make the renminbi more attractive, and therefore the bonds with a yield of over 3% more attractive as well. So this wide overvaluation of the 10-year treasuries in the USA over the Chinese government bonds is likely to narrow. And the 10-year yield is still holding this 1% area. So it has certainly put in a higher reaction low over the last couple of days. And this is an uptrend. It's held a sequence of higher reaction lows since August. And the I think we had some dip buying around the 1.2% level, but there is no incentive for people to start buying bonds below a 1% yield. Because when we think about, well, the central banks of the world, they don't believe that they've got inflation, because the kind of inflation they measure isn't showing up. But market-based inflation rates, forward swap rates, are at 2.38%. So if market inflation is around those levels, there is absolutely no incentive to pay for bonds with a yield of only 1%. Now, the big change that we've had over the course of 2020 has been that central banks no longer predict inflation. They've pretty much given up on predicting inflation, because about now 4 months is the beginning of currency wars. Christine Lagarde went to pains during her statement earlier this week to say that the market should not take for granted that the ECB is done with cutting interest rates. That is despite the fact that European interest rates are already in negative territory, because Europe does not want a strong currency. And the euro has appreciated meaningfully since March. The dollar has fallen by about 10%, and the euro's appreciation has pretty much taken all of that depreciation with it. So Europe is, in many respects, paying for the USA's willingness to tolerate a weaker currency and to support its economy. The European region has been caught flat-footed by the coronavirus. They acted slowly to curtail the spread. They went into lockdowns that lasted much longer than anticipated. They've had to go into multiple layers of the lockdowns. And then Europe in particular spent less than either the UK or the USA or China on developing vaccines. Then they didn't order enough of vaccines, or they didn't order them with sufficient urgency to secure early supplies. What we saw in here this week is that France is looking like moving back into a lockdown. And Europe has announced that they are going to ban exports. So this is another example of how protectionist Europe is. And this is for a region that tends to try to champion its role in promoting international trade and free markets. But as we've seen on multiple occasions over the years, that Europe's interests in free trade only extend as far as its own self-interest. So Europe needs a weaker currency. The entire European recovery is predicated on the recovery of exports. And a euro above 120 makes it a lot more difficult to spur those exports. But of course, then we can think about the fact that Europe sees where most of its exports are in fact going, and they're going to China. So the strength of the renminbi is at least acting as a salve against the appreciating euro versus the dollar, and the renminbi has held support around the 8 level, and it appreciated further in here this week against the euro. As we look at this trend and think about as mu try and get as much back history as we can get, there is a clear downtrend for the euro. We've had this very modest advance, but the one thing that we can say for sure is that now we have this wedging characteristic, and this looks rather toppy. So we have a lower high, and the euro is starting to come back down again. There's the clear scope that the euro is going to deteriorate further against the renminbi. And of course, that will help to bolster Europe's exports into China. But one thing that we can also see with Europe is that when it comes to business, they're willing to set aside any concerns about human rights. And signing a trade deal with China before Christmas is just a clear example of that. But of course, what it also raises the question is, what will Europe do in the event that the relationship between China and the USA deteriorates further? On what side of that conflict will Europe stand? Because the majority of its exports are increasingly moving towards China rather than the USA. Will they be willing to bite the hand that feeds them? Because one thing that we can certainly think about is that the European Union is not Australia. The Australian dollar continues to march higher, and although it is somewhat overbought in the short term, and it may have some pause in consolidation, this remains an upward trend overall. The efforts by China to impose tariffs on coal, wine, and agricultural products from Australia, although not iron ore, that is a reflection of its attempts to try and cow the Australian demands for an investigation into the origins of the coronavirus, and they haven't been particularly successful in really getting that done. But iron ore prices are starting to come back down, and or at least they have at least paused in the Qingdao market over the course of the last month or so. The reality is that with the credit impulse turning in China, that could have more of an effect on Australia than any tariffs that are imposed. Because it's one thing for tariffs not to have much of an effect when there is excess demand. But if the Chinese economy slows as a result of the credit impulse turning, then that will have a knock-on effect for iron ore prices. It remains to be seen how much of an effect it will have on the industrial resources overall. But what happens in China is obviously going to have a knock-on effect for the commodity-producing countries. Now, the equal weight commodity index has continued to push on to new high ground, but it is equally susceptible to some pause in consolidation. As we look out towards the lengthy medium term, there is the clear scope that we are going to move into more of a Green New Deal environment. The governments of the world are starved for tax income, so there is a clear effort underway to inflate the price of carbon credits. When we look at the commitments that politicians have made when they take office, and we just look at what was promised by the Conservatives to win power in the UK, they said they weren't going to raise national insurance, they weren't going to raise the top level of tax, and they weren't going to cut services either. And they're running historically large deficits, so there will have to be some form of revenue-raising measure. They could go for wealth taxes, but in the full knowledge that they are difficult to enforce, and that doesn't, of course, preclude the potential for wealthier people to simply leave, or they are going to have to come up with other taxes. So you don't raise the conventional taxes, you come up with unconventional taxes. And the most politically expedient way of doing that is to appeal to saving the world. And the prospect of additional carbon taxes is really probably baked in at this stage. So we're seeing that with some reticence to think about the reflation trade picking up in the next few weeks, that some of these commodities are coming under some selling pressure in the short term. And when we look at what's going on in Israel, I think it gives us what looks like a best case scenario, which is that the variants are not simply going to disappear, but that an aggressive vaccination schedule ensures that many fewer people end up in hospital. And the more vaccinations that occur, it means that confidence among investors and among the population at large can improve. Regardless of whether one believes that vaccines are necessary or not, or that the numbers of cases were inflated needlessly because of the use of PCR tests. And this use of PCR tests is still very active. I had an email just yesterday saying that, and I think this also is a great example of how politically motivated some of the actions around the coronavirus have been. The health authorities in Los Angeles County said in plain English back in September that they would not reopen until after the election. And the inauguration was a week ago, so now restaurants are open again. And the schools are sending out notices that sports teams can start coming back to do some training. But the advice has been that anyone who wants to come on campus needs to have proof of a negative test within 5 days of arriving. So, and they very clearly specify it must be a PCR test. Well, that is going to be an enormous headache. It means that I'll have to take my daughter to get tested at least once a week, and that is just so that she can attend fencing practice at her school. And that's only the very first demand to allow people back on the campus. So we're still in an environment where people are very wary, and it's probably going to take another 3 or 4 months to get sufficiently large numbers of people vaccinated, both with their first and second vaccination. The rollout of new vaccines, one-shot vaccines from Johnson and Johnson or AstraZeneca. What I find interesting is that AstraZeneca's share price continues to trend lower because of the difficulty in getting it out to people and the supply bottlenecks that have been underway. Meanwhile, Moderna, where there was issues with some of their doses last week, it has rebounded in emphatic fashion this week. Vaccines are absolutely necessary for politicians to sound the all clear, having scared the living daylights out of everybody in 2020. Then they said that vaccines were the only way that they were going to open back up, And it means that there's going to be aggressive measures to try and ensure that the majority of the population everywhere gets them. The potential for variants to the coronavirus to cause headaches is still very real. And the increasing pace with which these variants are spreading means that the plans for opening up will be slower than were initially anticipated. So it might run beyond the first quarter. Of course, I've thought for quite a while that we would be open by the end of the first quarter. By simply stretching that estimate out to maybe the end of the second quarter, I'm probably falling more in line with what most people were thinking anyway. But the reality is that governments have given up on predicting inflation. They are much more interested in reflation. They'll do whatever it takes to ensure that that is the case. But they're not going to improve the quantity of monetary assistance that's been provided until they have a good reason to. So then if we think about what's going on Wall Street, well, the S&P 500 pulled back and broke its sequence of higher reaction lows today. But it finished off the lows. And this is, I think, a picture of what else we can see in the markets. Everybody knows that if the market pulls back by 10%, then the Federal Reserve will quite likely intervene and supply additional liquidity. Well, if you're thinking that the worst case scenario is about 3,500, well then buying the dip today isn't probably viewed as being much of a problem. The issues, of course, are that even though government bond yields are starting to rise, inflationary pressures, as measured by the market, continue to appreciate. And this is only in the very early stages of this recovery, where supply chains are still impaired and we have some evidence of commodity price inflation, most particularly in the food commodities. There is the very real potential that this is the beginning of a new significant move. Corn prices are continuing to push higher. Now, that means that the corn is used as an ingredient in gasoline. It's used as feedstock for cattle and for other animals as well. So higher corn prices means higher food prices and also higher gasoline prices. Soybeans is really about cooking oil, but also about soya sauce. And then also as a source of protein for animals as well as people. And it has clearly broken out, and this looks like the first step and or the first consolidation following the breakout. The big picture, of course, is that we've got massive commonality right across the agricultural commodities sector. And this also is a great example of how we've had a step change in the marginal cost of production. It's unlikely that we're ever going to see soybean prices come back below 1800 or 800 cents because it is simply too expensive now to produce at those levels. As we then think about wheat, then it's primarily a foodstuff. So as wheat prices move higher, it's going to put pressure on marginal consumers. And it is food price inflation causes social distress, regardless of where it occurs. Now, we can then perhaps draw a line through or thread the needle between various events that are occurring internationally, because the anarcho-capitalist movement, people that are looking to disrupt the system, that has been a factor in a lot of different social programs and social upheavals over the course of the last decade, whether it was the rise of populism first in India, then in the UK, then in the USA, then in Brazil. whether it's the success of the cryptocurrency revolution or the Reddit revolution over the course of the last couple of weeks. Or as we look at these commodity prices moving, and I think we have to also look on the other side of the political spectrum at the mass protests we had in the middle of 2020, the calls for social justice and these flash mobs of people. This is part of what we're seeing, that the mob has become virtual, and it can coalesce around a theme in a very short period of time, and it can have an outsized effect on government policy, on sentiment, and on asset prices. But higher food prices are something that is a real catalyst for change. So we're definitely seeing that these base formation completions and the commonality right across the boards, whether it's in the grains and beans or in sugar or wheat or orange juice, we're seeing that there is a lot of evidence that prices are moving higher. And of course, all of this is a reflection of the fact that governments are broke. They can't raise taxes, so they're just printing the money. This is the knock-on effect of modern monetary theory. When the money in your pocket is devaluing in real time, then it has an outsized impact on asset prices. And that's particularly true on immovable objects like houses. There is outsized demand for houses. There is less supply. The new starts for building are at record highs. Now, we've had some pause in consolidation here as well in the home builders market, but it's still holding the region of the trend mean. There is obviously the clear potential that we could have a pullback in consolidation in the short term until we see some additional sources of liquidity being made available. The prospect of interest rates rising is virtually zero, at least until the Federal Reserve is in a position where they have some security in thinking that there is full employment or close to full employment, or a trend at least towards it, and that they have inflation rising in a trending manner. Well, that is likely to be extraordinarily beneficial for high growth markets. So that is one of the deciding factors behind the continued outperformance of the innovation ETFs. And so far, we've seen this really quite profound trend holding on. Eventually, we're going to get some pause in consolidation. There is no trend goes up in a straight line indefinitely. And we are definitely overdue some pause in consolidation. But as long as we have low interest rates and abundant credit, then that is likely to continue to stoke interest in new technologies. The evolution of deep learning is probably the most profound change that any of us have seen in our lifetimes, because it represents something that we've never seen before, that computers can write code themselves. If we think about how long it takes to train an individual to become adept at writing computer programs, then we're moving beyond that today. So obviously there will be demand for more technical education, but the grunt work of writing the code will no longer be required of people. Now, this represents a profound change, because then the output of code is no longer dependent on the keystrokes of individuals. And that means that the speed with which it can occur will multiply. The efficiency gains that can be brought to bear with computers doing productive, creative work is orders of magnitude beyond what we are used to. And this will have untold changes for the entire global economy, because anything that can be digitized will be. Now, this is most particularly true of the healthcare sector, because just the data in one human brain is equivalent to the entire data stock on Google. So as we look at what the future holds, then the realm of data mining and data acquisition is going to multiply in an incredibly profound manner. So there will be massive value creation in the technology sector. That doesn't mean that technology shares go up in a straight line. And funding that performance is obviously going to be dependent on access to abundant liquidity and low interest rates. But if we think about where we are in this market, there's still a lot of cash on the sidelines. There have been pockets of frothiness in relatively small asset classes, but the vast majority of people are still very cash rich. And if that's the case, yes, there is the potential that we're moving into a bubbly phase. I think everybody now gets the message that abundant liquidity leads to asset price inflation. So as long as we have that, it's going to represent a tailwind for speculation. And we might be at high valuations today, but we have to also consider that we're just after coming through a very profound recession, and earnings took a significant hit. It takes time for those earnings to recover, and as they recover, valuations tend to contract. But of course, that also creates the rationale for moving into more of a bubbly phase overall. And that, I think, has to be the base case, that many people describe a bubble in terms of something that's about to pop. But a bubble has to be inflated first before it pops. The two things that pop bubbles are higher interest rates and the taking away of the punch bowl, which is exactly what's going on in China right now to try and ensure that a bubble doesn't form. And alternatively, that supply needs to increase in an extremely dramatic fashion. But bull markets don't end because demand evaporates. Bull markets end because supply increases and liquidity decreases. And we are just not there yet. We've definitely seen a lot of new IPOs. But comparing the number or the quantity of money that is being put into SPACs and IPOs at present, and comparing that to the 1990s, that doesn't make a lot of sense in my view, because the dollar values that we have today are nothing compared to what the ones in 1999 are nothing compared to what we have today. The depreciation of the purchasing power of the dollar when we've had trillions printed over the course of just this year means that it's normal to anticipate high dollar values for SPACs and for IPOs. And there is still a lengthy pipeline of multi-billion dollar companies that are about to go public. So we know that supply is increasing, and supply should increase. It's a necessary condition in a bull market, because the best time to sell your company is when you think you can get more for it than you believe it's worth. So as prices rise, it should encourage new supply into the market. And therefore, the number one thing to pay attention to is interest rates and liquidity. When we eventually do get tightening coming through, particularly from the USA, then that will be something that could mark the end of this bubbly phase. But I think that we're probably more towards the beginning of the bubbly phase than the end. And I think that I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.